Department of Defense. Unbeknownst to Timothy Leary when he attempted to levitate the evil Pentagon in 1967, this little-known branch of defense was quietly kick-starting the computer revolution that would result in the Macintosh. I don't want to pretty this up too much now. The interest of the Defense Department was, of course, the development of systems that could toast the flesh of opposing soldiers and noisome bystanders. But from the start, ARPA's leadership was enlightened. The very first person in charge of the Information Processing Techniques Office was J.C.R. Licklider, whose dreams and desires ran parallel to Engelbart's. To overthrow the status quo, where computers were accessed only indirectly, by way of submitting punch cards and waiting sometimes for days for the results. Licklider was an early advocate of computer interactivity. In 1960, he was writing papers proposing a man-computer symbiosis in which human brains and computing machines will be coupled together very tightly, and the resulting partnership will think as no human being has ever thought and process data in a way not approached by the information handling machines we know today. When he went to the Pentagon in 1962, Licklider, and later his like-minded successors, set up a system that allowed them to toss millions of dollars at research centers trying to realize this goal. For 8 years, the money flowed, modestly by defense standards, topping out at about $25 million a year, until some persnickety senators forced the agency to limit its spending only to projects with specific military applications. Yet, during its golden run in the 1960s, ARPA was probably the greatest government investment since the Louisiana Purchase. Compare it to its contemporary, the space program. The latter focused on a single mind-blowing goal, a moon landing, which was successfully met. And then the enterprise fizzled, becoming decreasingly relevant to the general public. The main benefits of the whole enterprise seem to have been Teflon, Tang, and a stack of very cool photographs. ARPA, by using its relatively meager bankroll, millions, not billions, to seed an entire culture devoted to transforming computers into instruments of communications and mental augmentation, bootstrapped a revolution that would change the way all of us worked, created, and thought. Contemplate the actual products: word processing, personal computing, desktop publishing, spreadsheets. Not that Doug Engelbart would personally reap the fruits of this transformation. Even as the trajectory of his thought kept rising in the early 70s, the clock was ticking on his pet project. In 1973, enchanted by the ideas of economist Peter Drucker, he co-authored a paper called The Augmented Knowledge Workshop, which was based on the idea, formulated by Drucker, that information was destined to be the fulcrum of the economy. By 1960, wrote Engelbart, the largest single group of Americans was professional, managerial, and technical. That is, knowledge workers. By 1975 to 1980, this group will embrace the majority of Americans. It was those knowledge workers who would sit in the cyber cockpits of the Engelbart augmentation scheme, as he termed it, the office of the future. Knowledge workers, the office of the future. These two catchphrases would later be appropriated by the marketers charged with selling the Macintosh, but Engelbart's bosses at SRI weren't concerned with marketing his product. They tolerated him as long as he was funded, and then he lost his funding. In retrospect, it seems hard to fathom. It's as if someone, the biggest idiot in the annals of technology, had handed Edison his walking papers. Lock up the lab, Tom. Take this junk with you. Some people attributed the problem to what was increasingly becoming a mismatch between the conservative SRI and the iconoclastic augmentation group. Others claimed that Engelbart's vision was too rigorous, that it demanded too much from the poor knowledge workers. Hey, the future isn't easy. In the early 1970s, some key members of his team fled to a fledgling computer research center set up by the Xerox Corporation. And in 1975, after a less extravagant ARPA pulled its golden plug, the augmentation research team broke up for good. SRI sold the system to Timeshare. By then, the team consisted of one, Douglas C. Engelbart, once again a solitary dreamer. Engelbart's voice was brittle when he explained the move. There was a slightly less than universal perception of our value at SRI. Not that Timeshare, his current employer, had a deep appreciation for what they had purchased. It was a cheap way to take a chance, said Engelbart, not bothering to cloak his bitterness. By the time I wound up in Engelbart's pathetic cubicle in 1983, his creation, now dubbed Augment, was one of several office automation systems Timeshare offered. There was little fanfare, yet to Engelbart, it was still his baby. He talked as if his system, not the evolutions of it like the Lisa or the upcoming Macintosh, was going to take over the world. It was logical to him that it should. Here, he seemed to say, just watch. I sat there slack-jawed as he demonstrated. The most memorable portion of his system, perhaps because of his unfamiliarity, was the little one-handed key set that could be corded like an electronic piano. Using that in one hand and a mouse in the other, he could make lines of text appear on the screen without once touching the standard keyboard. Seeing this, I had to admit that anyone who learned how to play this thing would have a huge advantage over the laggards wed to our current antique. But to get this part of the system into the mainstream, Engelbart would have to overthrow a technology entrenched more doggedly than the Maginot Line, the QWERTY typewriter keyboard. Everyone knows what a dog that interface is. If it seems like the QWERTY keyboard was laid out deliberately to slow down speed typists, that's because it was. If people typed too fast, they would overwhelm the machine. The keys would jam. So inefficiency was built in. A good idea for the 19th century, when text was produced by pounding a lever to make an impact on a piece of paper, but not so good 100 years later, when hitting a key sends electrical impulses to a silicon chip. Yet we stick with the interface. There's too much invested in the standard to abandon it. My own high school instruction in typing was nightmarish. So fumbled-fingered was I that after my mistakes were deducted from my word totals, my scores on the speed drills were usually gauged in negative numbers. Yet I knew, since my handwriting was universally regarded as illegible, that in order to make my thoughts known in the world, I had to learn the keyboard, and eventually I internalized the skills. This ability is so hard-won that I cannot imagine attempting something as elaborate as a QWERTY handset. Engelbart's system could take you farther, faster, than anything that had come before it, and arguably has not been eclipsed to this day. But it required several weeks of intensive training to master it. This is not a lot to ask of rocket scientists, brain surgeons, and plumbers, but for knowledge workers, this was and is an insurmountable barrier. Better to go slow every day for the next decade than to lose a few weeks learning to move at hyperspeed. Still, Engelbart got farther than anyone had reason to expect by postulating an addition to the keyboard, the mouse, and seeing it accepted in his lifetime. To boot, he was the first to implement Windows in computer screens, transforming a single video monitor to the multi-screened Hydra envisioned by Bush with his Memex machine. Since gathering the wealth of Croesus was not Engelbart's goal, one might reasonably assume that his achievements brought him satisfaction. When I suggested as much, Engelbart curtly gestured to his system, a full-fledged wonder with not only mouse and Windows, but the QWERTY handset, the networking, and the implied connection to the world's knowledge via the portals of cyberspace. He wanted this system, his system, everywhere, but he had no control over the future. His vision was at the mercy of those he inspired. Chapter 3. The next leap towards Macintosh would originate only a few miles from Engelbart's lab, a research and development arm of the Xerox Corporation called the Palo Alto Research Center, but known to computer heads everywhere as PARC. It would become famous, but not quite in the way its parent company intended. PARC's establishment in 1970 came as a consequence of the Xerox Corporation's extraordinary success. Xerox was literally synonymous with copying machines. The revenues piled in, and the profits piled up. But the company's future was far from assured. Making copies of documents was but one component managing information. The emergence of advanced computing tools would create new components, possibly some much more significant than even the most advanced copiers. Xerox had gotten into the computer field by buying a California company called Scientific Data Systems, but Xerox's CEO, Peter McCullough, realized that the office of the future, to use Engelbart's term, was yet to be invented. He decided to spend some of Xerox's profits to invent it. Thus, Park was born. Though the head of the research center was a respected scientist named George Paik, the key figure at Park was a non-engineer, Bob Taylor. Straight out of ARPA, where he had succeeded J.C.R. Licklider as head of the Information Processing Desk, Taylor ran his domain as if it were somehow a continuation of the ARPA effort to push computation into the realm of the intimate. As surely as an ACC basketball coach is familiar with the country's top high school prospects, Taylor had kept track of the nation's bright young computer scientists, particularly the freewheeling wizards who aimed to hack up miracles, and he landed the best. It did not require much wooing. Word was out that something special was afoot in Park's faux Aztec complex built into a mound of rugged terrain on Coyote Hill Road near Route 280. The ARPA A-team gladly fled their universities and artificial intelligence labs to make a bit of history. The pay wasn't bad either. This is really a frightening group of people, by far the best I know of as far as talent and creativity, said Alan Kay, one of the center's principal scientists in 1972, smack in the middle of Park's golden days. The people here all have track records and are used to dealing lightning with both hands. Kay, himself a frighteningly talented person, also once claimed that out of the 100 best computer scientists in the country, 76 of them were at Park. One of his former colleagues, upon hearing this, remarked dryly that Kay's estimate was suspect for the very primitive reason that we didn't even have 76 scientists. Yet, Park's brain power was truly impressive and is now safely ensconced in legend. There still is a Xerox Palo Alto Research Center in the very same building on Coyote Hill Road, but when people talk of Park, they generally refer to the collection of computer science magi who populated the center in the 1970s. Nerds now think of it as Camelot. While the nation discoed, Park redefined computing. Its scientists sat on beanbag chairs, stacked to the ceiling in meeting rooms, at conferences people would file in, grab one, and flop down on the floor, and rethought the symbiosis between man and machine. And then they created a marvel. It was unique for its time, but now would be identified as sort of looking something like a Macintosh, but not as good as a Mac. I miss visiting Park during his Camelot era, but if I'd gone, surely the first person I would have sought out would have been Alan Kay. His intelligence is well documented. A radio quiz kid at age 10, a restless, unchallenged student through high school, a passionate musician distinguished at the pipe organ, and, as he discovered during his stint with the United States Air Force, a virtuoso computer programmer. He used his coding skills to finance his undergraduate education at the University of Colorado, and somehow came to the attention of Dave Evans, the head of computer science at the University of Utah. In 1966, Kay was admitted to Utah's graduate program. Though these days the University of Utah is best known for its attempt to solve the world's energy problems through the magic of cold fusion, in the mid-1960s it was a hotbed of computer innovation. The hidden hand in bringing this about was, of course, ARPA. It had given Evans, a former Berkeley computer scientist, a $5 million grant, which allowed him to go wild with computer interactivity and graphics. Evans pried a lot of talent from vaunted computer palaces such as MIT, but his biggest prize of all was Ivan Sutherland. Sutherland had achieved canonical status in the field by devising a computer program called Sketchpad. He had concocted this as his MIT doctoral thesis in the early 60s, working on the TX-2, one of the first computers with a visual display, albeit an extremely crude one. It filled a room, Sutherland later recalled. It was about a 20th the power of a Macintosh 2, but it was at that time a very big machine. The TX-2 had a remarkable feature. Using a flashlight-like wand called a light pen, one could input shapes into it. Sutherland had, since childhood, harbored a fascination for geometry and mechanical drawing. His father was a civil engineer. So, as he later explained, it seemed like the most natural thing to make drawings with it. Natural for Sutherland, perhaps, but few had imagined this rough beast of a calculating engine could be transmogrified into a sophisticated system to create shapes, pictures, and blueprints. And when you created your shapes, you could copy them, alter them, or store them. In 1977, Ted Nelson, whom we will later meet when our story turns the hypercard, gushed about Sutherland's Wonder, the most important computer program ever written, he called it, in his book, The Home Computer Revolution. Working on a screen, you could try out things you couldn't try out as a draftsman on paper. You were concerning yourself with an abstracted version of the drafting problem. You didn't have to sharpen any pencils or prepare a sheet to draw on or use a T-square or an eraser. All those functions were built into the program in ways you could use through the flick of a switch or the pointing of the light pen. And the drawing itself existed in an abstracted version that could be freely changed around with no loss of detail. Sketchpad was not only the first drawing program, but it was arguably the best, absurdly ahead of its time. It's as if the designer of the very first automobile had created a 1967 Corvette. Sketchpad was also, for many years, the thing that most clearly anticipated Macintosh. Sketchpad did not feel like a computer program, at least none that had ever been thought of as such. It felt like pictures, like geometry, like cyberspace. Suddenly, we could see the pictures of purely mental terrain that entranced Plato when he talked about mathematics. And we could play in it, wander through it together, point to things. Sketchpad was never destined for general distribution. It ran only on the TX2, a computer with a production run of 1, and was never ported anywhere else. And it never affected the culture nearly as much as less significant but flashier advances in computer science, like, say, chess-playing programs. Still, when presented to a receptive mind, Sketchpad could twist that mind into a pretzel. Using the Saurian machines of the 50s and 60s, it was all too easy to think of computers as simply crunchers of numbers, of shufflers of ones and zeros. Very few people, even among the new cognoscenti of computer scientists, have the imagination to see how versatile ones and zeros could become. They could be pictures, sounds, characters, the cells of new creatures, the building blocks of new worlds. Sketchpad changed all this. The program profoundly affected those who spent time with it. Among those was Alan Kay. When Kay arrived at Utah, Dave Evans immediately dumped Sutherland's Sketchpad thesis on him. Kay understood its significance very quickly. Sketchpad made the computer an extension of a single person's mental terrain, made it personal. For the next 2 years, Alan Kay attempted to design a new kind of hardware, something that most people thought a wretched excess, a personal computer. He called it the Flex. It was groundbreaking, or would have been had it been built, because it wove the lessons of Engelbart and Sutherland into a compact package. It had a tablet as a pointing device, a high-resolution display for text and animated graphics, and multiple windows, Kay later described it. But its Achilles heel was the interface, which its creator admitted in retrospect was repellent to users. One thing he got right was the use of little pictures, later called icons, which people can point to in the course of recalling previous work. But generally, Flex was a mishmash. The combination of ingredients didn't gel. It was like trying to bake a pie from random ingredients in a kitchen. Bologna instead of apples, ground-up Cheerios instead of flour, etc., wrote Kay. This failure led Kay to an examination of what a user interface meant. The term commonly referred to a set of screen prompts and commands that allows a person to communicate his or her wishes to the computer. The practice of user interface design has been around at least since humans invented tools, Kay later noted. Yet very little thinking had been devoted to promoting friendly, intuitive computer interfaces. Could an interface be designed so that ordinary people could use it? This was an unconventional question in those days, and was rarely assumed that ordinary people would ever have reason to belly up to a computer keyboard. But Kay already was pondering ideas like people relating to a computer intimately. He found himself reading Marshall McLuhan's Understanding Media and pondering its seminal koan, "The medium is the message." Then he had his flash of enlightenment, a shock that reverberates even now, he wrote over 20 years later in The Art of Human-Computer Interaction. The computer is a medium. I'd always thought of it as a tool, perhaps a vehicle, a much weaker conception. What McLuhan was saying, as if the personal computer is truly a new medium and the very use of it would actually change the thought patterns of an entire civilization. Kay was further influenced by a visit to MIT when he sat in on some of Seymour Papert's experiments with children and computers. Papert, a student of Piaget, had developed Logo, a computer language specifically designed for children. Eventually, Kay came to the conclusion that the only computers worth designing were those simple enough to be used by children. If the computer is only a vehicle, perhaps you can wait until high school to give a driver's ed on it. But if it's a medium, then it must be extended all the way into the world of the child, he wrote. To satisfy this rather revolutionary standard, the software in the computer would have to present itself to the user in a totally intuitive manner, enough to entice even the most naive operator into a close collaboration, one in which the user is welcome to manipulate the microworld inside the machine. Whereas previous systems, from the punch cards and batch processing systems of IBM to the dense code words of Unix, tacked on an interface as an afterthought, Kay understood that future systems would have to be built around a genial software physiognomy. What is presented to one's senses is one's computer, he exclaimed. He and the other Park people would call it the user illusion. In other words, the consensual hallucination that William Gibson named cyberspace. To do what Kay wanted, the very language of the computer would have to be convivial, in a way that no previous computer language was. In fact, all previous computer languages, even the supposedly easy ones like BASIC, were a nasty thicket of thorny syntax, geared to the needs of the machine rather than to the habits of human beings. Kay wanted more of the flexibility and creativity of a natural language. He understood how languages shape the thought processes of the people who use them and believed the computer languages could do the same. Yet, natural languages emerged through an evolutionary process and thus were somewhat shaped, implicitly yet with unerring sense, according to the needs and desires of its speakers. A computer language had no such advantage. It was thrust upon users in one chunk. Only a very wise designer could come up with something that was intuitively grasped, flexible enough to support complex operations, organized enough to promote new efficiencies, open enough to permit creativity, and fun enough for kids to enjoy. He'd call it small talk. At the very least, it was fun for Kay to design. For a better understanding of intuitive learning, he immersed himself in the works of Piaget and Jerome Bruner, examined the philosophies of Montessori and Suzuki violin, and even became a disciple of tennis guru Timothy Galway, key apostle of the inner game of tennis. For years, Kay's appearances on the lecture circuit featured an amateurish-looking video of elderly women using Galway's system to learn an astonishing amount of tennis in an afternoon. Kay claimed that those lessons could be applied to computer design. It showed that the best interfaces were those free of interference and capable of focusing attention on what was really important, the task at hand. One thing in particular about the interfaces of that period got the goat of Park's wizards. This was the practice, almost universal in computerdom at the time, of using modes. A mode is a current status, a condition. Software designers use them all the time. Most word processors had an input mode. When you were in that mode, you could type in new text. But to change the text, you had to exit that mode, using a specific command and enter edit mode. You constantly had to remember which mode you were in at any time, because something you typed while in one mode triggered an entirely different event in another mode. Compare this anal retentiveness to a piece of paper, the world's greatest interface. No mode whatsoever. You write text, you doodle, you cross things out. Quite literally, a tabula rasa. But try to get a computer to be as flexible as a piece of paper, and very quickly you understand that thousands of dollars worth of silicon and design genius gets lapped very quickly by one sheet of 20-pound bond. In his own interface design, Kay strived for the clarity and breadth of a piece of paper. He finally cracked the problem by a sleight of hand called overlapping windows. While Engelbart and his augmentation workers had pioneered the window, the partitions they had in mind each staked out its own portion on the monitor. Not only was it difficult to keep straight which window one was working in, but the windows wound up competing for the extremely limited real estate on the screen. Kay's solution to this was to regard the screen as a desk, and each project or piece of a project as paper on the desk. It was the original desktop metaphor. As if working with real paper, the one you were working on at a given moment was on top of the pile. You could write happily in that window, or draw, or read a letter. Perhaps you could see corners or edges of those windows previously created. To move to the other windows, you use the mouse to move the cursor out of the window and over the representation of one of the windows underneath. That window would immediately fill out, giving the illusion that it was on top. As Kay later wrote, "This interaction was modeless in a special sense of the word. The active window constituted a mode, to be sure. One window might hold a painting kit, another might hold text, but one could get to the next window to do something in without any special termination. This is what modeless came to mean for me. The user could always get to the next thing desired without any backing out." In other words, as far as the computer was concerned, it was in a mode, but the user felt the freedom of modelessness. Switching windows was natural. If you view things a certain way, we're always switching modes in everything we do. It's a mode-mode world. But in non-computer life, we don't have to stop and recite a secret word every time we change activities. Look down from the television to the newspaper, watch the baseball, and swing the bat. We just do it, and thus don't worry about what mode we're in. Kay understood that our computers should allow us that freedom too, and Smalltalk did. Later, Park scientists developed word-processing features that extended those ideas. Instead of having to switch between input and editing and deleting mode while editing, the user would make the text selection first by pressing a button on the mouse and dragging the cursor over the words in question. This in itself was a huge improvement over mouseless word processors, which require you to painstakingly mark the cursor positions at the beginning and the end of the passage you wanted to cut or move. The text in question would be highlighted in reverse video, like a photo negative. Only then would you inform the computer what you wanted to do with the text, and this would be done not by a command, but by pressing a button on the mouse that triggered a little pop-up window to appear near the selected text. This new window was in the form of a menu, a stack of single words that represented commands, like copy, cut, paste, and undo. Moving the mouse over the command and releasing the button caused the action to occur. The sequence of actions is much easier to perform than describe. It takes only a few hours of working with the system to become adept. And the modes were gone. A major barrier between human beings and digitally stored information had been lifted. But for most people, this style of interaction would remain unknown until it became part of Macintosh computing. Kay's team worked on Smalltalk through most of the 1970s. The original idea was to use it as the operating system of Kay's dream computer, the Dynabook. A dynamic media for creative thought, Kay called it. Imagine having your own self-contained knowledge manipulator in a portable package the size and shape of an ordinary notebook. Suppose it had enough power to outrace your senses of sight and hearing. Enough capacity to store for later retrieval thousands of page equivalents of reference materials, poems, letters, recipes, records, drawings, animations, musical scores, waveforms, dynamic simulations, and anything else you would like to remember and change. But it wasn't too long before Kay ran up against the impossibility of producing a Dynabook until close to the millennium, if then. The state of technology in 1971, as it would be 20 years later, was insufficiently advanced to implement Kay's ideas. Instead of sulking about this unpleasant reality, Kay kept talking about the Dynabook, and word about it spread so widely it is probably one of the most influential computers in history, though it has never been built. The Dynabook turned out to become less a real object than a vision for an object. Everyone in the industry knows what a Dynabook is and regards it as a sort of technological bullseye to aim for. Indeed, Macintosh itself was explicitly designed as something that would evolve into the Dynabook. Steve Jobs once fed a slogan to his team, "Mac in a book in 5 years." It took 8. The Alan Kay style of virtual designing which he continued long after visualizing the Dinah book, consists of creating imaginative abstractions of what can be, going through the motions of gathering a team to build the thing and discovering important new techniques and innovations in the process. The real product is the body of ideas that circulate from the vision. Kay himself has conceded that technological wizards generally fall into two categories: the Michelangelo types who dream of Sistine Chapels and actually spend years building them, and the Da Vincis, who have a million ideas but seldom finish anything themselves. In this bifurcation, of course, Kay was the ultimate Da Vinci. There were Michelangelos at Park. In a shockingly brief time, they managed to produce a working computer that ran Smalltalk, sort of an interim Dinah book. This was the Alto. Butler Lamson, a Harvard-trained physicist-turned-computer scientist, shared Kay's vision of transforming computers from the exotic to the personal. Though he knew that Kay's design specifications for the Dinah book were entirely too demanding, he also understood that recent advances in technology would enable relatively tiny machines to do heavy-duty computation that, paradoxically, would make them simpler to use. Lamson wanted the Alto to be as powerful as a mini-computer, but less expensive, devoted to a single user, and above all, radically more intuitive than any machine that preceded it. It would have some of Engelbart's innovations, but a much less imposing learning curve. Like Kay, Lamson got misty-eyed at the possibilities, which included swarms of Joe Sixpacks transmogrified into computer programmers. Millions of people will write non-trivial programs, and hundreds of thousands will try to sell them. Of course, the market will be much larger and very much more diverse than it is now, just as paper is more widespread and is used in many more ways than our adding machines. Almost everyone who used a pencil will use a computer, and although most people will not do any serious programming, almost everyone will be a potential customer for serious programs of some kind. Within about 4 months of intense work in late 1972 and early 1973, Lamson, with Park hardware wizard Chuck Thacker and other engineers, produced prototype Altos. Almost to underline the difference from his straight-laced predecessors, the first image to appear on an Alto screen was Cookie Monster, the voracious biscuit biter from PBS's Sesame Street. Alan Kay's group had used the image as a test pattern. Here was a truly powerful computer, and its first offering was something personal, whimsical even. It was a gauntlet tossed down to the concept that computer time was so precious that not a moment should be wasted. The Alto was different, geared to forgive the meanderings and peccadilloes of an individual user. What excited the Parkoids was that, unlike the time-sharing machines they were used to, the Alto ran just as fast during the day than it did at night. Experienced programmers had grown accustomed to late-night computing binges when fewer people would compete for the cycles of time-sharing computers. It's an empty exercise to compare the Alto with other computers using machines with statistics like random access memory and millions of instructions per second executed by the processor. The important thing to know is where the power and memory of the machine was directed, to making a complex graphic display on the screen and allowing an ultra-fast response when the user keyboarded a command or moved the mouse. These two abilities are worthy of separate attention. The Alto graphics were its most striking characteristic. Computer screens in those days, for many years thereafter, were what was called calligraphic or character-based. When the user typed a letter on a keyboard, an action much in the spirit of a typewriter occurred. A code was triggered inside the computer memory to generate the letter on the screen, and that information triggered phosphors on the screen to paint the letter. Calligraphic screens generated drawings in the same fashion. This was efficient. It took very little code to display a complicated graphic, but because the electron beams were subject to flicker, the display never looked very good. It looked, well, like a computer, a standard of quality endlessly inferior to that of a printed piece of paper in the cheapest book or newspaper. The Alto left all that behind, aiming for the intensity of paper and ink. It used bitmapping. Every single pixel on its screen, a spacious landscape about the size of a legal document, was mapped to a single bit of the computer's memory. Depending on whether that bit was flipped on or off, the pixel on the screen would be dark or light. Bitmapping required a huge amount of computer memory. The Alto screen consisted of 500,000 picture elements. That amount required about $7,000 worth of computer memory in every machine. Thacker understood, however, that this was a temporary expense, and if memory costs fell at the expected rate, that sum would be well under $100 in a decade. Still, bitmapping was worth it. It was part and parcel of making computation an experience as intimate as using paper and pencil, and inestimably more powerful. Once you bitmapped, the computer regarded everything on the screen as a graphic, whether it was an alphanumeric character, a bar chart, or a richly shaded portrait of a human face. For the first time it was possible, it was assumed, that the display on the screen would be a precise analog of what the eventual output would be when generated on a high-quality printer. It is now common practice to call this feature What You See Is What You Get, voiced as the acronym WYSIWYG and pronounced WYSIWYG. Not particularly mellifluous, but the pronunciation has caught on. The other notable feature of the Alto was the full integration of the mouse, which had made its way to Park along with some refugees from Engelbart's lab. Xerox had done a lot of testing on the mouse. Bill English, one of several SRI workers who had left Doug Engelbart to pursue the bitmap dream of Xerox PARC, later explained that experiments conducted with people with blood flowing in their veins, as opposed to computer scientists who bled binary, resolved any doubt remaining about the superiority of the mouse as a pointing device. Fewer than 1 in 10 users had difficulty mastering the rudiments of mouse control. Why? Basically, using a mouse is like pointing a finger at something. The befuddled 10% were presented with a little exercise called Fly. The logic of Fly was simple. There is a fly on the screen that is bothersome and should be exterminated. The mouse controls a fly swatter. Use it to kill flies. Go. After 10 minutes, said Bill English, of those who used this remedial training program, they would be perfectly at home with the mouse. This easily acquired point-and-click skill could be put to use instantly on an Alto, enabling people to select text and invoke menu commands at will. With bitmapping, pointing, and Windows, the Alto delivered a welcome alternative to all previous computers. Instead of being challenged by the infuriating command line, all your vital information, your working files, were spread before you like a sylvan vista from a mountaintop cabin. Getting to your work was now as easy as sitting on the porch and pointing to that tree, there. As refreshing as a verdant countryside might be to a desk-bound knowledge worker, this was obviously not the ideal metaphor for a screen display. The key to an intuitive system in a so-called graphical user interface was familiarity, and the way to accomplish this was by a suitable metaphor. Metaphor, it turns out, is the key to making computers comprehensible. It was not until the late 1970s when two Harvard Business School students named Dan Bricklin and Bob Frankston used a metaphor easily accessible to people who would work with money, accountants, economists, bookkeepers, and anyone who ever wrote a business plan, that personal computers crossed the line from a hobbyist obsession to a compelling tool. The metaphor was that of a spreadsheet, the grid of rows and columns of figures by which one calculated profit and loss. Their electronic spreadsheet was called VisiCalc, and it had many advantages over its paper counterpart, not the least of which was that it liberated users from tediously having to recalculate the entire spreadsheet to reflect changes caused by changing a single number. This freedom allowed people to experiment without penalty and actually changed the perception of a spreadsheet from a document of hard costs into a modeling tool by which one tested business scenarios. The software metaphor was not only superior to the real thing, it became the real thing. Now, when people speak of spreadsheets, they do not refer to the green graph paper where spreadsheets used to live. Those are useless now. Spreadsheets are tools on a computer. Some years after the development of Smalltalk, the scientists at Park came up with a brilliant metaphor for computer screens. Like all great software advances, in retrospect, it was obvious. The very desktop to which the knowledge worker was bound. It was a considerable extension of Kay's idea that overlapping windows were like papers on a desk. In the final Xerox implementation, on a computer called the Star, there were icons representing file cabinets, printers, in and out boxes, file folders, and of course, paper. Instead of choosing a file from a directory, you would actually see the file. Instead of invoking a command to print, you could actually move the cursor to the printer. The office metaphor was indisputably one of Xerox PARC's greatest leaps. Though Alan Kay's original desktop metaphor involved only the concept of using overlapping windows to represent papers on a desk, the term desktop metaphor quickly came to stand for this broader concept, including tools throughout the office. Like many other brilliant ideas, once introduced, it is unimaginable to conceive of working without it. Smalltalk could potentially offer an infinite number of scenarios, each of them a new world with windows opening into the information scape. What better way to emulate the sort of work that most of us do with computers, desk work, than by making a virtual desk with virtual drawers, virtual file folders, virtual paper? Though the Alto was one of the truly revolutionary information processing products of the century, the lords of Xerox were never quite sure what to do with it. As documented in Fumbling the Future, a book about Xerox by Douglas K. Smith and Robert C. Alexander, there were plenty of lame reasons for this failure, from corporate politics to timidity to outright misunderstanding the marketplace. Certainly, every time the Alto was exposed to the world outside the sleek monastery Route 280, the response was terrific. Xerox placed a few Altos in the Carter White House, but did not publicize the enthusiastic reaction. And when Xerox conducted an experiment whereby a group of secretaries used Altos equipped with a word processor named Gypsy that exploited the computer's friendly virtues, the result was astonishing. Within a few hours, they were working productively on it. Still, Xerox surrendered the word processing market without firing a shot, allowing companies like Wang to dominate with systems that were clunky, overpriced, and hideously arcane. Xerox eventually did make an attempt to sell PARC's concepts in a real product, the Affirmation Star. Adopting the paradigms of Smalltalk and the Alto, and drawing from the experience of users exposed to the 1,000 or so prototypes of that machine, the Star's designers considered their creation a potential word changer. "These paradigms change the very way you think," they wrote in an article in Byte magazine. "They lead to new habits and models of behavior that are more powerful and productive. They can lead to a human-machine synergism." The emphasis is theirs, apparently a case where the writers yielded to the ease with which one could generate italics with the Star. In retrospect, these wild claims are well in line with reality. Yet it was not the Star that presented those paradigms to the masses. It was the Macintosh, and later its imitators. Xerox blew it again. It had no idea how to sell the Star, which at $18,000 for a basic model, and much more for a fully loaded setup, was an awkward buy for a corporate manager. As a Xerox executive put it succinctly to the authors of Fumbling the Future, the Star was a technological tour de force, but it was too expensive, no one understood it, and no one wanted it. Though the PARC researchers were understandably frustrated by Xerox's inability to introduce their advances into the marketplace, they weren't exactly despondent. By and large, they viewed themselves as pure researchers. A prototype, a paper, an article in Scientific American, those were their products. They had little faith that the hoi polloi would very soon be using computers. In contrast, a small group called the Homebrew Computer Club met twice a month at the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, not more than an aerobie toss from PARC itself, discussing and implementing the beginnings of a personal computer industry. One of the Homebrew members was Steven Wozniak. He designed the first Apple computer to impress his fellow clubsters. When PARC scientist Larry Tesler attended a Homebrew meeting in 1976, his disdain was indicative of his peers' attitude. "I watched guys carrying around boxes of wires and showing programs that generated flashing lights. My neighbor said, 'This is the future.' I told him, 'Forget it.'" Compared to the sophisticated digital wonders of Coyote Hill Road, the homebrew hackers were playing with arrowheads and sticks. What the PARC people did not understand, however, was that people accustomed to performing tasks with their bare hands would consider even primitive tools like arrowheads and sticks miraculous. Tesler would soon change his mind, both about personal computers and his priorities. He came to realize that actually shipping a product was as important as conceiving it, and thus the concept of making idea reality moved up several notches in his cerebral stack. But others at PARC never really came around. I find the purest expression of Park's elitism in this comment by Park hero Butler Lamson when interviewed by Susan Lammers for her Programmers at Work. Were we aware of the outside world? Yes, we knew that it existed. Did we understand the whole situation entirely? Probably not. Were we surprised when Xerox was unable to sell stars? No, not really. The purpose of Park was to learn. You owe something to the company that's paying you to learn, and we felt we should do what we could within reasonable bounds to benefit Xerox. But it wasn't critical that Xerox developed those ideas. Their failure was not really surprising. Some things went wrong in marketing. That sort of thing is annoying, but the main product of a research laboratory is ideas. The scientists at Xerox PARC proceeded as if they were working with ARPA grants, not corporate funds. They were satisfied to learn, to come up with new ideas, and to nudge the field forward. And if, as Lamson explained, it could be done within reasonable bounds, they would actually do a little something for the company paying their salaries. This was stark contrast to the scrappy engineers at Apple Computer, whose job it was to create new products that would both change the world and bring in some cash. The ethic was more practical. If it didn't hit the streets, it wasn't worth doing. Ideas were useless if they didn't get out there. For the Macintosh, the most important design consideration was getting it on people's desks. As for new ideas, yes, the Apple folks cooked up a thick stew of them, but the best ones were borrowed. They were, of course, the ideas concocted and nurtured by the computer science Illuminati at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Chapter 4. You can have your Lufthansa heist, your great train robbery, your Crown Heights caper, and your Brinks job. For my money, the slickest trick of all was Apple's daylight raid on the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. It was December of 1979 when the Princes of PARC received a group of visitors working on a new computer for Apple, to be called Lisa. The unusual excursion was the culmination of some high-level negotiations between Steve Jobs and the people at Xerox Development Corporation, a branch of the copying giant specializing in venture capital. Apple was in the midst of soliciting new investments to sustain its meteoric growth, and Xerox's investment arm was interested. Here was the eventual deal. In exchange for allowing a development corporation to buy 100,000 Apple shares for $1 million, Xerox would host a contingent of Apple engineers for a peek at PARC's wonders. The number crunchers at Xerox considered this a fairly innocuous concession. They were getting a tangible stock deal in exchange for allowing Apple a brief exposure to technology that, in their minds, belonged more to science fiction than to future revenues. Even the PARC people didn't think much about the impending visit. Demos to outsiders, if not an everyday occurrence, were not unusual. One person designated to show small talk on the Alto to the outsiders was Larry Tesler, chosen largely because he was one of the few engineers who thought the personal computers were anything other than a joke, a grudging change from his first visit to the homebrew club 3 years previous. Tesler had actually purchased a few early PCs. Still, at the time, he regarded those working in the field as belonging to a lower class of technologists than he and his peers. They were a bunch of hackers, and they really didn't understand computer scientists, he told one journalist. They really wouldn't understand what we were doing and just see pretty dancing things on the screen. The 8 representatives of Apple were ushered into a demo room. There were Steve Jobs, Bill Atkinson, Apple's president Mike Scott, and various executives and engineers on the Lisa project. Tesler flicked on the Alto. The paradigm of augmentation came alive. Windows, bitmapping, icons, pop-up menus, mouse. The Apple people might not have been trained as computer scientists, but they had an instinctual sense of what was good technology. This was very good technology. They wanted to know everything about it, how it was done, what were the limits. Science fiction writer William Gibson's oft-noted aphorism applies here, sort of. The street finds its own uses for things, uses the manufacturers never imagined. Already, the junkyard mentality of Apple engineers was hard at work, imagining what could be done with the concepts before them. Often at PARC demos, newcomers failed to comprehend the marvels before them. They would rave for 20 minutes about the mouse and totally ignore the significance of bitmapping. The scariest response came once when, after a virtuoso demo into the frontiers of computer science, the lucky recipient commented, "You really get good reception here." But the Apple people were incredibly sharp. Tesla would later admit that in the 7 years he had been at Park, nobody, whether a casual visitor, Xerox executive, or computer scientist, had queried him with such insight. He later learned that they'd studied the small talk literature before the visit. "It was almost like talking to someone in the group," he later told me, "but better, because they wanted to get it out into the world." Tesla was so impressed, in fact, that a few months later, despairing of Xerox ever getting his act together, he left Park to seek employment in the personal computer world. At Apple, of course. Tesla recalled Bill Atkinson sitting with his face almost pressed against the screen. Meanwhile, Steve Jobs could hardly contain himself with excitement. After he watched Tesla manipulate the screen display, open windows, click on icons — the Apple people were not permitted to handle the goods — he nearly exploded. "Why aren't you doing anything with this?" he bellowed. "This is the greatest thing. This is revolutionary." Steve Jobs, Bill Atkinson, and the others walked out that day with something much more valuable than diamonds, treasury bills, or even gold bullion: a paradigm. By the time Xerox noticed they had the idea, it was already much too late. Apple had gone off to start the revolution without Xerox. The Engelbart Park paradigm was the bedrock from which Apple was to construct the future, first with the Lisa, then the Macintosh. The payout so far? As Carl Sagan might say, billions and billions. Dollars aside, the true significance of that day was that for the first time, the wonders of augmentation, of informationscape, of working in a world of metaphor were demonstrated to people who would do something about it. The drive back to Cupertino was only 15 minutes or so, but before it was over, the Apple people were already discussing how to change the world with the ideas to which they had just been exposed. "How long do you think it will take?" Steve Jobs asked Bill Atkinson. "About 6 months," Atkinson replied. He was only off by 3 years or so. At the time of the Xerox visit, Apple Computer Inc. had been incorporated for less than 3 years, but was already the world's leading personal computer company. But it was much more than that. From its start, Apple was never a mere corporation. It was a symbol. Depending on your point of view, it could symbolize the information explosion, the entrepreneurial revolution, or the maturation of post-60s baby boomers. Its roots were legendary. College dropout and former engineer Steve Jobs had a savvy knowledge of technology and a bent towards promotion. And Steve Wozniak, a.k.a. Woz, Jobs' friend from Homestead High School in Cupertino, California, had a computer. Jobs, then 22 years old, had not only convinced Wozniak to leave his job at Hewlett-Packard to form a company with him, but the pair managed to recruit some savvy venture capital, as well as support of the key public relations firm in Silicon Valley. Steve Jobs' garage was company headquarters in 1976, when the two Steves, aided by a couple of high school kids named Chris Espinosa and Randy Wigginton, both of whom would work on Macintosh, were preparing the Apple II computer for its debut as a product early in 1977. The Apple I had been a single circuit board, sort of a prototype for the real thing. The garage was fun, a few hackers making an extremely neat machine. Wireheads and hackers were uniformly impressed by Wozniak's virtuoso design. They regarded his motherboard, the main circuit board, as a beautiful work of art. But the Apple II had broader appeal. It was the first personal computer capable of being appreciated by a wider audience than hobbyists. It could output colorful graphics on the screen, had a solid version of the basic computer language built in, and was housed in a friendly plastic casing. Those who spent time with the machine also came to see a special magic in it. Somehow, the insouciance and verve of its designer came through. Most of all, it was a real computer, designed for use by an individual, and priced not at $100,000, as most people assume computers cost, but under $1,500. It was the main force in compelling people to consider the possibility of having something as exotic as a computer on their own desktops, and thus it was destined to become a landmark in the industry, selling millions and making the Apple name virtually synonymous with personal computers until IBM entered the field. It was also to make both Steves very rich and famous. "It was like inventing a new form of transportation," recalled Chris Espinosa. "A computer was something that had been heretofore seen, but only in a larger, more expensive, more cumbersome form that was reserved for the elite. This was like raining gold upon peasants. There was a sense we were on the cutting edge of something new and important, and that we could change the world with what we were doing. Very few of us realized that changing the world had financial implications." As a consequence of the company's success, Apple very quickly had to shift from a garage mentality to the mindset of a budding corporation, one valued at the time of the park visit at over $1 billion. It filled several low-slung buildings in Cupertino and had hundreds of employees. Though the Apple II was wonderful for its time, Apple's leaders realized that the company needed new products to remain competitive. They began work on the Apple III, a machine roughly as powerful as IBM's personal computer would be. But Steve Jobs had an idea for something even more special, Lisa, a computer that would leapfrog Apple's technology, surpassing not only the Apple II, but the Apple III as well. This jump would also vault Apple a generation or so past anything its competitors were preparing. Begun when Steve Wozniak, at Steve Jobs' request, sketched its architecture on a napkin, Lisa had, in less than a year, evolved to a computer based on the powerful Motorola 68000 microprocessor chip and was engineered to handle more complicated applications, even running several at the same time, a trick called multitasking. Named after an Apple engineer's daughter, and allegedly an additional tribute to Jobs' own daughter, Lisa was also the first Apple computer specifically directed at office professionals, from white-collar workers to captains of industry. If you picture the Apple II as a Volkswagen Bug whose speedometer stopped at 90, the Lisa was a German sports car with a needle that topped out at 180. To produce Lisa, Apple had hired away engineering and management talent from a serious computer company, Hewlett-Packard. At the time of the Xerox visit, Apple had a working prototype of a machine that reeked of serious intent. The model they kept in mind was the Hewlett-Packard 3000, a mini-computer that had never cracked a smile in its life. Yet from its start, Lisa had been inherently interesting. The concept had always been a thorough integration of text and graphics. Lisa's most promising feature thus far was the work of Bill Atkinson. Fast software routines